Reading from the Bible this morning, from Matthew chapter 3. In those days came John the Baptist, preaching in the wilderness of Judea, and saying, "Repent ye, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. For this is he that was spoken of by the prophet Isaiah, saying, The voice of one crying in the wilderness, Prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his path straight. And the same John had his raiment of camel's hair and a leathern girdle about his loins, and his meat was locusts and wild honey. Then went out to him Jerusalem and all Judea and all the region about Jordan, and were baptized of him in Jordan, confessing their sins. But when he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees come to his baptism, he said unto them, O generation of vipers, who hath warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Bring forth therefore fruits meet for repentance, and think not to say within yourselves, We have Abraham to our father. For I say unto you, that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. And now also the axe is laid unto the root of the trees. Therefore every tree which bringeth forth not good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. I indeed baptize you with water unto repentance. But he that cometh after me is mightier than I, whose shoes I am not worthy to bear. He shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire, whose fan is in his hand. And he will thoroughly purge his floor and gather his wheat into the garner, but he will burn up the chaff with unquenchable fire." Quite fierce, isn't he? We have our new Cross and Lotus journal, so please get one today. And from the dear friends, "Dear friends, Mother Hamilton liked to tell a story about a Methodist minister who was at Anandashram at the same time she was in 1957. Having heard many of Papa's stories about his Ram adventures, the minister asked Papa if he could accompany him the next time Ram prompted Papa on a journey. One day Papa told the minister that he was being directed by God to go across a field. I can imagine the minister may have had visions of high adventure. What might happen? It would seem that all the world lay open to him being with Papa that day. Halfway across the field, Papa suddenly, and without hesitation, turned around and walked back to the ashram. When the minister asked why they had turned around, Papa said that when they reached the halfway point, Ram had directed him back. Now, Papa did not waver when turning back. He did not question why there was a 180-degree change. He did not worry about looking foolish in front of the minister. He just turned around. This is a favorite story that I like for its stark simplicity and insight into Papa's complete surrender to God. Such surrender is what sadhakas strive to have. Carla and I came to such a moment when we were at Anandashram. Our plans had been to stay on at the ashram for another 6 weeks, followed by a trip north to see our friends, Swami Mayatreya and Gargi. Ram was having us leave immediately despite these well-made plans. Some devotees were coming to the ashram, at least in part, to be there when Carla and I were there. Our plans to meet friends in the north and have the darshan of a saint, and a planned weekly satsangs we had been asked to hold by the ashramites, all of this and more had to be surrendered when we left. Knowing that it was the will of the infinite that we leave, I knew that those coming to Anandashram would be in God's tender care, that everything was working out exactly to his plan. There was disappointment all around, but I also knew without a doubt that I must return, that I must turn around where we were only halfway across the field. To live a life of perfect surrender is to live in complete freedom. However, it also requires full faith. Faith is more than belief. It is founded upon a direct and intuitional glimpse into the divine. As an aspirant for realization progresses, he experiences three forms of surrender. The first is represented by Moses, the lawgiver. In India, it is Manu, the lawgiver. As the sincere aspirant seeks attunement with God, he initially learns the do's and the don'ts of spiritual principles. For instance, don't tell lies, always tell the truth. Respect life, don't commit murder. Do not steal, but show self-respect and respect others. Do not worship false idols, always aspire for the purest form of consciousness, etc. The second form of surrender comes when the intellect is guided by intuition that comes in the form of a feeling or a hunch as to what to do in certain situations. This intuition is scripturally represented by John the Baptist. John the Baptist's intuition comes primarily from the solar plexus, or the gut, as a feeling for right action. When John the Baptist's intuition matures, it forms a strong feeling idea that the kingdom of heaven is at hand and that it is time to make the way straight of the Lord. It is then that a dispassion for the world becomes dominant and makes you strive for self-realization, a time of purification and cleansing. The third type of surrender comes from a higher form of knowing. Through purification of the mind, one may know what is right through direct perception of divine consciousness or Christ consciousness. John the Baptist comes in order to prepare the way for the coming of Christ consciousness. The perfect clarity that comes with this higher consciousness makes the vast difference between the intuition of John the Baptist and the coming Christ consciousness perfectly clear. The words of the Baptist that he is not worthy of tying the shoes of the Christ is not just a statement of humility, but of fact. Christ consciousness comes as direct knowledge that is far beyond the mental concept of right and wrong, and also stands high above a feeling or hunch. Christ consciousness resonates throughout your entire being and illumines your intellect with the light of wisdom. Surrender is a theme that runs throughout the Old and New Testament and all the great spiritual traditions. In one of the truly great spiritual epics, the Ramayana, Ram is fully expecting to become prince regent. But instead, in order to keep his father's word, on that day of his crowning, he walks penniless into exile for the next 14 years, not even allowed to enter a town. In his surrender, he is actually fulfilling the ultimate purpose for which he was born. We know that purpose as readers, but he is not aware that this moment of surrender is leading to a grand destiny, only that he feels honored to fulfill his father's reluctant promise. Surrender can range from when you have to choose to do some right action in your life when you would rather not, all the way to giving your life for your fellow man in order to fulfill your Heavenly Father's will. It all requires willingness to submit your will to a higher one. It is through this complete surrender to the highest light you know that your mind is purified and you are prepared for the attaining the ultimate of Christ consciousness. So we left India earlier than anticipated, but we are happy to be with God wherever he takes us. We miss our friends at Anandashram, but we are able to be with our friends here for important events, even as he willed. The same lesson in surrender comes back again and again in deepening layers through your instantaneous surrender to God. You fulfill the marvelous destiny that God has designed for you from the foundation of this creation, and it is good. This idea of surrender is something that from the beginning of our sadhana to the very end is a theme that we continue to deepen in our understanding. As I wrote here, in the beginning, we learned the do's and the don'ts. For those of us who have been initiated into Kriya, Mother gave us some very simple principles to follow. And some of those were that we would agree not to use recreational drugs or drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes or have sex outside of marriage. And it is through these principles that are intended to keep us safe, to keep us in the mode of purification of the mind, that we enter into this path. We also take the vows that we will practice Kriya Yoga every morning and every night. These are some simple things to do, and yet it is amazing that how much of a battlefield these areas become in our sadhana. For some, there are two or three things that are very easy to do out of this list, and others that prove to be very difficult. I know for myself that there were times when I didn't want to enter into meditation because of the things that I was facing as I was entering into there. It can come in a very subtle kind of a way. At first, you just simply miss a meditation, perhaps. And then it extends to a second, and then a third, and you're not even quite certain why it's happening. You're not very concerned about it in your own mind. And it becomes a pattern, and if you could look below the surface, you would see that there's a reason why. If you experienced tremendous bliss every time that you entered into meditation, then you would naturally want to meditate more. You would be drawn to it. But when you encounter the things of the past that you yourself created, and they're dark, they're negative, they're difficult, then you start to shy away from that because it's just easier, so you think. You don't encounter those things when you divert the mind into the things of the world, or at least you encounter them in a less dark, contrasted way than you do in meditation. And so it takes great courage, it takes great tenacity, it takes great willpower to continue to take yourself back to that meditation battlefield. Sometimes we think when we enter into this spiritual life that it's just going to get easier and easier. And we can be quite surprised when things get more and more difficult. When Mother first went to Anandashram, she had gone through many spiritual experiences already and many difficult things. And when she went, she was fully expecting, perhaps just to get the final touch from Papa Ramdas, in order to get her full realization. She had already entered into the state of Nirvikalpa Samadhi, but she knew that there was something more for her to go through. And so when she went there, and then she entered into this most difficult, tremendous mystical crucifixion, it came as a great surprise to her. It's not what she was expecting to have happen. And people who have gone to Anandashram since that time many times have been caught by surprise in greater or lesser ways than Mother was, because they expected things to go smoothly, to be bliss-filled, and they got anything but. It was a testing ground. It was a kind of crucifixion for them. And so they were tested every day. And sometimes people came to me and they say, I just want to go home. I just want to leave this place. This is so difficult for me to be. But they bravely continued on. And I think, without an exception, everyone is glad that they did. Now, Mother was absolutely determined to stay there until God gave her permission to leave. And at one point, her husband said, we must leave here. You need medical attention. And if you don't get it, they're going to end up burying you here. And Mother said, so be it. I will not leave until I feel God's sanction to leave, and I don't feel it now. And if that means death of this body, then so be it. Such was her tenacious grip on going all the way to her full God realization. So she was leading us through example in the attitude that we must strive for as well, even as Jesus led us in his example. Now, it's interesting that as we go from the do's and the don'ts, we go into that intuitional guidance. that intuitional guidance that comes from John the Baptist, which is centered down at the solar plexus. And that is where your ribs just split apart there above your stomach. And it's a sensitive nerve cluster that's there on the physical realm. But in the astral realm, it represents even something more. There's a highly developed sense of intuition there. When you meet somebody and perhaps you get a sickening feeling or a dark feeling from them, you just want to take a shower after you've been around them. Because it just feels dark, it feels ugly. And that is coming from your John the Baptist center there at your solar plexus, or you walk into a room and you just feel an instantaneous liking for it. It feels comfortable, it feels good, even though it may not be a very elaborate kind of place to enter into. There's a spiritual vibrancy about it. I remember entering into a small cave that Nityananda inhabited. He lived in near Anandashram. And he had a small cave that he carved out with his own hands there. And it was wonderful to be able to enter into there. And when I entered in, I just instantly felt the spiritual power of this great God-man who had lived there. He's a wonderful saint. He just showed up at a particular place and he started to live there. And the children would come nearby, and out of his dhoti, which was not very large at all, he would just bring out candy from seemingly nowhere, and he would throw it to all the children, and they would gladly take it. He lived up in a tree for a long time. He'd stand up on the branches of the tree and just stood there in all kinds of weather. It didn't bother him one way or the other. And eventually he came to this cave, and he created a cave, and an ashram was built out of that place. And it's a lovely place to go and visit. We used to go and take an early morning walk before the sun would come up. We would go there and then walk across these fields and then across a lake that had just a small path across it. And it was beautiful to be out in the early morning like that. It's so warm. It's very warm even in those early morning hours. And the sun would rise just as we were going across the lake. And eventually we would come to this small ashram that is just inhabited. The time that we were last there, there was just a cook there, and she made us the most wonderful bit of chai and was very sweet and welcoming. So it's a very small ashram that is not well attended today. But entering into that cave just felt a vast expanse within that cave and such a spiritual power that it was unbelievable. And so it doesn't have to be a richly decorated kind of cathedral that you enter into. It can be the simpleness of a hut where a saint has lived, or a cave, or it can be any place at all. It can't be a wonderful cathedral where there have been great saints and spiritual beings, but there's a difference in measuring things from physical beauty and spiritual beauty. And in that tiny cave that you had to crawl to get into, there is such tremendous beauty, such spiritual power. And really, it should be a place that people aspire to go to because of its greatness. So we can't judge with these outer eyes only by something that is physically beautiful. But we get a sense, we get this John the Baptist intuition, a feeling, a sense of a place that we instantly like or don't like. And as that develops, eventually it comes to the point where we become convinced within our being, beyond our own reason, that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. This happened for me in my late teens, and it's actually beyond my own intellect. My intellect was resisting this whole going into the spiritual nature, and yet on a feeling level I couldn't resist it because I was in a miserable dark state. I was in a spiritual darkness and I was keenly aware of it. And it was this growing knowledge inside of me that there was something beyond this material creation that represented the true reality that I was searching for, that would be the resolution to the spiritual pain that I was feeling. I didn't have any words for it at the time, I wouldn't have been able to describe it in those words. These things came later. But at the time, I just knew that when I read about things of the East, philosophy, experiences of saints, I felt tremendously attracted to that. And I knew that it was in this direction that my future must lie. Because as I looked around me in the world, I didn't see anything that attracted me. There are no adults, there are no situations in this world that I yearn to have or that I yearn to be a part of. And so this is John the Baptist coming, make straight the way. And that he wore sackcloth and ashes, that he lived on very simple kinds of food, of locusts and honey, is symbolically representational that you no longer have interest in this world. You only want things that are higher, that are beyond that. And you go into this baptism, you want to get washed clean of all the darkness, of all the pain, of all the misery that this world represents. And you want to enter into a new life. You want to have this baptism wash you clean and you feel clean from the inside out. So this is a very definite experience that you go through, and you must go through it. And that experience brings you to the Christ. Now, in an outward sense, it brought me to Mother. Because Mother, as a symbolic representation of the Christ consciousness, and she was the one that God had deigned to take me from the human to the divine. And it was through her teachings, it was through her example, it was through her vibrational power that she emanated that was to lift me up. When I first met her, I felt that power, I felt that transformation happening within me. And it thrilled me. It lifted me up. And I didn't even understand it. Again, it went against my own reason in many ways. Because in my own reason, I just wanted to live an ordinary life, so to speak. A life oriented towards the world. And yet, this pain, this difficulty would not leave me. And I would say 99% of the time I spent in the first years with Mother was more in pain than it was in bliss, I can tell you. But I knew with everything inside of me, as I grew in consciousness, I didn't know it from the very beginning because I was a hard sell in that sense. I didn't want to be on a fool's errand. And I certainly didn't want to just accept what somebody else said and as a truth and to learn and to memorize something and to parrot it back. That wasn't what I was interested in. I wanted to know the truth and I wanted to know bliss. Those were my two criteria. And if it didn't contain both those criteria, then I wouldn't be satisfied. So I continued on for several years, back and forth, wondering, is this all real? And every time I would go and I would hear Mother, I would feel that same uplifting power, and I feel that transformation happening inside of me. And it began to convince me through and through, and then I began to have experiences in God. And these transformational experiences began to change me. I remember the first time when I was in Africa, North Africa. I was traveling there, and I was out in the middle of the Sahara. And while there, I just had this experience that felt as real as anything in the physical, if not more, where I smelled Mother's perfume that she used at the time. And I smelled that fragrance, and I looked around, and I didn't see any reason why that fragrance should be there. And then I felt Mother's presence there so strongly. And it helped me to know that wherever I was, Mother was there in spirit. And that this was something that would follow me wherever I was, no matter where. And it's these kinds of experiences that gradually convince you into the core of your being. And then I started into these kundalini experiences, and I was surprised how physical they were. At one time, I think I may imagine, well, these are things that are very subtle that come to the mind, and that you get these experiences, and they're somehow not as real as this material world. That's the material mind at work. And you can demand from God that your spiritual experiences be at least as deep, at least as impressionable as these things that we get from the world. Because your material mind, too, needs to be lifted up, needs to go through this transformation. And so God brings it to you in a very powerful kind of a way. Now, if God created everything that is, including this material creation, including this body, including the experiences that we have in this body, in this world, then He's at least as powerful as any impressions that are left upon you by this physical realm. So it stands to reason that God will be at least that powerful, if not more. And so these experiences come into your body, and you get this upliftment in your spine, and this transformation starts. Now, this is the beginning of entry into Christ consciousness. It's not Christ consciousness itself, but it's the Christ being born inside of you and then being lifted up through your spinal system. And these things are absolutely tuned to your own nature. Mother had these things in very, very powerful ways because she was doing it not just for herself. She had already attained complete God realization in a previous lifetime. But she was doing it for the sake of this world and to bring about the truth of these Christian teachings so that all the world may know the truth behind the parables. And that these things are not just about individuals that lived 2,000 years ago, but they're your experiences. This is your life story, at least the blueprint of it, being told through these stories. And so John the Baptist comes into your awareness. In the beginning, you get it as hunches, you get it as feelings, then it gradually builds as it matures into this full John the Baptist experience where he proclaims the coming of the kingdom of heaven. It is at hand. It's here and it's now. Now, this is a challenge to many modern-day Christians who are expecting this kingdom of heaven to happen at death or at some other time when Jesus has come from the clouds, and they've been waiting for 2,000 years for it. He said it was at hand. Now, that sounds like more than a 2,000-year prediction. Or something that's to come at the end of your lifetime. When Jesus was talking to a young, pure soul, and the young, pure soul said that to love your neighbor as yourself and to love God with all of your heart, strength, and mind, that Jesus said you are very close to the kingdom of heaven. He's saying here that the purity of this individual's consciousness, that he was able to perceive that truth and to bring it all down into those two teachings, showed that he was very near the kingdom of heaven. So if the kingdom of heaven is at hand, and the kingdom of heaven is attained by a purity of consciousness and recognition of truth, now this individual that Jesus was talking to wouldn't meet the criteria of modern-day Christians that he was a Christian. He wasn't following Christ in that sense. He was merely articulating the truth as he had realized it within his own being. So this puts to challenge all these modern-day assertions around the interpretation that modern-day Christians, many of them, put onto these scriptures. These are universal teachings. They're not meant just for a few. They're not just meant for those who follow a particular philosophy or even those who follow Jesus' teachings. Anyone who has a spine and a brain is capable of attaining into this God consciousness, this Christ consciousness. Now, when Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," he means it. But he means it in that his example, what he demonstrates, what he teaches, how he lives his life is the way. And it is the way that we must all follow, and it is a way of surrender, that his life is a life of surrender to God from beginning to end. And his own parents lived that life of surrender as well, both Joseph and Mary. They are both given very difficult tasks to handle. Mary was given as a young girl that she was going to be pregnant. Now she's an unmarried young woman, although she's engaged to a man. And of course, the father would know that she was not pregnant by him. And in those days, a woman could be stoned. She could be killed for such an action. And so God is telling her this through one of his angels. Now, inwardly, an angel is a pure thought that manifests out of God, that comes into your consciousness. And so this revelation comes that this birth is coming. So from a human standpoint, Mary's given a tremendously difficult test. As a young woman, she could be killed for this. And yet, what does she say? She says, I'm a handmaiden of the Lord. And she deeply surrenders to God's will in that moment. Joseph is also given a difficult, perhaps not as difficult, but another difficult task to give. Here he is, he's engaged to a young bride to be, and he's given this message from his fiancée that she's pregnant. Now he knows he's not the father in that sense. And so he has to wrestle with that, and he does. And he could turn her over for stoning. He could put her away, and she would live a life alone for the rest of her life in shame. But he doesn't do that, and one night he has a dream. And in that dream, he too gets a visitation from an angel. And he gets an inner assurance that what she says is the truth, and that they must carry this forward. And in deep surrender, he too surrenders to that higher light, to that higher consciousness. Now these are all examples for us. We may not face exactly what they had to face, but we have our own tests. We have our own things that come along that make it difficult. I wanted to read from you from the account of Ramakrishna, where he talks about the effect of other people's actions and thoughts on you. Master Mahasaya writes, Sri Ramakrishna was sitting on the small couch. The room was filled with devotees who had taken advantage of the holiday to come to see the master. Master Mahasaya had not yet become acquainted with any of them, so he took his seat in a corner. The master smiled as he talked with the devotees. He addressed his words particularly to a young man of 19 named Narendranath, who later became Swami Vivekananda, who was a college student and frequented the Sadaran Brahmo Samaj. His eyes were bright, his words were full of spirit, and he had the look of a lover of God. M guessed that the conversation was about worldly men who look down upon those who aspire first to spiritual things. The master was talking about great number of such people in the world and about how to deal with them. Master to Narendra, how do you feel about it? Worldly people say all kinds of things about the spiritually minded. But look here. When an elephant moves along the street, any number of curs and other small animals may bark and cry after it. But the elephant doesn't even look back at them. If people speak ill of you, what will you think of them? So just think of this yourself. If people speak badly of you, if they find fault with you, what do you do with that? How do you react to that? Narendra says, I shall think that dogs are barking at me. Master smiling, oh no, you mustn't go that far, my child. And everybody laughs. God dwells in all beings, but you may be intimate only with good people. You must keep away from evil-minded people. God is even in the tiger, but you cannot embrace the tiger on that account. Again, there's laughter. You may say, why run away from a tiger, which is also a manifestation of God? The answer to that is, those who tell you to run away are also manifestations of God, and why shouldn't you listen to them? Let me tell you a story. In the forest there lived a holy man who had many disciples. One day he taught them to see God in all beings, and knowing this, to bow low before them all. A disciple went to the forest to gather wood for the sacrificial fire. Suddenly he heard an outcry, "Get out of the way, a mad elephant is coming!" But all but the disciple of the holy man took to their heels. He reasoned that the elephant was also God in another form. Then why should he run away from it? He stood still, bowed before the animal, and began to sing its praises. The mahout of the elephant was shouting, "Run away, run away!" But the disciple didn't move. The animal seized him with its trunk, cast him to one side, and went on its way. Hurt and bruised, the disciple lay unconscious on the ground. Hearing what had happened, his teacher and his brother disciples came to him and carried him to the hermitage. With the help of some medicine, he soon regained consciousness. Someone asked him, "You knew the elephant was coming. Why didn't you leave the place?" "But," he said, "our master has told us that God himself has taken all these forms of animals as well as men. Therefore, thinking it only to be Ganesh that was coming, I didn't run away." At this, the teacher said, "Yes, my child, it is true that Ganesh was coming. But the Mahout God forbade you to stay there. Since all are manifestations of God, why didn't you trust the Mahout's words? You should have heeded the words of the Mahout." And so it is that we are tested when we come up against what other people think, what other people say. What will they think of us? I remember so oftentimes that I was shy about my own spiritual life, what other people might think or what they might say. And it is right, particularly in the beginning, that we build a small fence around us, because the seedling has been put into the ground. Perhaps it started to grow into a small tree, but it needs protection against beasts and other animals that would come and crush it out of hand. We must protect it. And so it is all right to not broadcast it to one and all, particularly in the beginning. But as you grow, you become a tree that can give shade and comfort to others, that birds of heaven can come like angels and nest in your branches, and truth can be given. A fruit begins to appear within the tree, and that fruit is your God realization. And to allow that fruit to be taken, plucked away, and cast to the winds will allow truth to be able to spread over this world. That every great spiritual master has faced that moment of truth when they could allow their deepest, most wonderful, beautiful secrets to be broadcast out to this world, or to retain it only for themselves. Now there is a definite choice, and you can choose to retain it only for yourself. But if it is truly God who is given through you, and it is through his compassion operating through your heart and mind, and he wishes to broadcast himself through you, then who are you to stand in God's way out of a false sense of humility that oftentimes has a fear lurking behind it? A fear of what other people will say, what they will do. Many of us have come through these dark ages, and it's been a rough playhouse. There have been deaths, there have been murders, there have been tortures, all kinds of things, and sometimes things done in the name of religion. And so we have learned to hide away those things rather than to let our light shine. But Jesus also used the example of a lamp lit. And he says, what good is a lamp lit if it is hidden underneath a bushel, if it is hidden underneath some obstacle that doesn't allow any of the light out? It must be set up onto a tabletop. And if it grows very strong, it can be put up onto a hilltop to guide those who are journeying so that they may be able to find their way better. So in whatever way that God chooses to manifest through you, you know, if you're not manifesting life and light within your own being, you really have to ask yourself, who am I as a sadhaka? Who am I as a spiritual aspirant? If I've been on this path for so long and I have no life light worth sharing, then what am I about? What am I doing here? Am I really digging deeper? Am I going higher? Am I really getting after God? Or am I just simply treading water? Am I looking all right on the outside, but on the inside, I'm not really making the progress that I know that I can, that I know that I must, in order to satisfy myself by the end of this world? John the Baptist comes in a very fierce way, and he says some terrific things here. He says that, first of all, an axe will be laid to the root of the tree that does not bear fruit. If you're not bearing the fruit of light, if you're not bearing the fruit of greater God realization, then you're going to have that axe laid to your root and to all roots that don't bear the higher fruit, the higher consciousness, because those things must be taken down. And then what are they done with? They're put into the fire. There is a winnowing fan that takes out the wheat kernels and leaves behind the chaff, the outer husk of those kernels. And that must be done in order to make the wheat worth anything. And so the truth begins to emerge out of your being, and everything else is cast into that fire. Now the Christ brings that fire. That's the fire of Kundalini that burns within you. And you throw everything into that flame. You throw everything into that fire that is not of God. And everything there is burned. This is a difficult path. This is a difficult journey in that sense. But it is the resolution of all sorrows and all ills. Otherwise, you carry those things that are of darkness, that are of untruth within your own being. And they don't go anywhere. Sometimes people think, well, I'll just make it through this life until I die. Then I'll find out what the truth is. Then everything will be resolved. Then I'll get a free ticket into heaven. But it doesn't work that way. And Jesus himself says it doesn't work that way. That everything must be paid for. Every dot and every tittle. And so it is within ourselves that our karma must be paid for. We must face ourselves. And the work that must be done here, and must be done now. We are entering into this realm, this time of life, where we celebrate the birth of the Christ. And to hear John the Baptist's words, to really distinguish between that which is of God and that which is not of God, to put our minds upon God. Now we can think to ourselves, I've been on this path for so long, I just live with these things that seem to plague me. I guess that's just who I am. And that is one of the most spiritually deadly thoughts that a devotee can have. To abandon yourself to some age-old habit. Just because you were born into this world with that habit, and you carried it with you from beginning till now, doesn't mean that that's who you are. And instinctually, intuitively, you know that that's not true. Because you yearn for the truth. You yearn for freedom. You yearn to go into that final step of surrender. And in that stage of surrender, when John the Baptist calls to you, and you surrender everything that you are, everything that you ever hoped to be, in a human sense, in a worldly sense, and you give it all to God, knowing that he wants your good for you. And whatever your ultimate and highest good, people look at the darkness and the bad things done in this world, and they blame God for it. Now you can say, in an ultimate sense, as Papa has realized within his own being, and all great masters have ultimately realized within their own being, that God is the author of everything that is, and therefore God is everything. But when you realize that, you don't become bitter. You don't see Papa being bitter about this world or afraid of this world when he says that God is the author of everything. He sees this world as joyful, a joyful, blissful, light expression. Now, when you look out through your human eyes and through your human intellect, you don't see it that way. when you look at it from a human point of view. And that is because you have not yet purified the mind to come to see that it is all God. So if you blame God for everything in the ultimate sense, but you're not seeing God as an expression of joy in everything that he does, then you're really telling a lie to yourself. You're trying to interpret through your own human intellect what this highest of experiences tells you when you come into it. So from a human standpoint, we don't say that everything is of God, because not everything represents the purity of God from a human aspect. Do you see what that means? It means that there is both human and divine. There is the world of duality, and people make their own decisions. And through those their own decisions, they put this world into a world of cause and effect. Now, cause and effect can even affect, as Mother and other great masters have told us, even the volcanoes, even the things, the cycles of this world. Everything becomes affected because it's a tremendous power that's put into motion. Now, some people may have difficulty with that, but that's all right. The truth is the truth, and what you realize in the end, you will know at that point through your own state of realization. But that even the forces of nature are affected by humankind's consciousness. And therefore, everything that we see, everything that we see manifest, is a result of this long chain of cause and effect of mankind. And human beings have free will, therefore they can go against the will of God. Now, we know in our own lives, we don't always do what God chooses for us to do. We consciously go against that will because of our own desire nature, our own fear takes us in that direction. So it is at this moment in time, we don't hold God responsible for everything that is from a human standpoint, because mankind bears a responsibility living in separation from God, which mankind chose to do. Individuals all across chose to enter into this world in a duality. And the resolution to all of this is to surrender yourself to God's will, knowing that what he wants for you is for the highest good and will set right all the things that have been done from the past. Now, if we could but know it, if once you set your resolution upon attaining God, you are put through certain tests, you are put through certain experiences. You have to choose God at each step of the way. But the reality is, you don't have to resolve everything that you did in your outgoing nature of God. Master said that the Guru takes a third, that God takes a third, and that it's up to us to do the other third. But we must do our part. We must do our part. I have here a quote from Sri Yukteswar. An entity said, this is at the time of initiation, it is said that Swami Maharaj used to say to the following to disciples at initiation, "Hear this, you should never think that you will be liberated by this touch, or that a carriage will be ready to take you up to heaven. You should never allow yourself to get this blind faith way of thinking towards achieving Kaivalya, or liberation. The initiating touch of the Guru just helps to encourage to realization. You yourself have to practice with greatest sincerity to achieve the divine goal, and this will be through your own self-efforts." So we must be willing to do it from beginning to end, and to put our shoulder to the wheel, and to surrender to the highest light that we know. Sometimes people say, "Well, I don't know if it's God's will that's directing me." And so my advice at those times is, one, is to go deep as you can, to find out what God's will is for you. But even at that, if you are faced with a decision that you have to make, and you're not absolutely certain it's God's direction or your own inner direction, then go according to the highest light that you know in that moment. And as you proceed forward, remain sincere in your desire to do God's will. And when you do that, even if you make a mistake, and the course you choose is not God's will, your sincerity will quickly bring to mind that John the Baptist's intuition at your solar plexus, and you'll get a feeling that something's wrong here. You're off track. It's different than the feeling of fear or anxiousness at doing something that you're not sure if you can accomplish it or not, or what other people might say about you. It just will feel wrong to you what you're doing. And as that grows inside of you, pay attention to that. Learn to distinguish that between a limiting fear or anxiety that might be a normal occurrence when you try to do something that is new or difficult. So let us enter into this season, honoring the birth of the Christ into this world, with new determination, a new resilience, a new focus of attention. Let us bring our whole mind to bear upon this birth of the Christ within us, and that we might walk in the footsteps of the Christ and of the great ones, that we may know that it is God who resides within us. Yesterday we had our 6 hours of silence and meditation, and toward the end of it I had a wonderful experience, and God prompted me to write it down and even to read it to you today. And it reads, in the last part of our 6 hour monthly meditation, I asked God, after a very full day of experiences, is there anything else you have for me now? He responded with a tremendous inner sound, and then an enormous cathedral of light opened before my inner sight that extended far into the distance. Columns of light on either side added to the light already shining from this marvelous structure. Then, with tremendous speed but no sense of motion, I moved toward the front of this tremendous cathedral of light. At the front was a tunnel of light, and in the center of the tunnel was a magnificent 5-pointed star. I then merged into the star and left the cathedral as I saw that same light spread all over this world. I felt impelled to write of this singular experience out of several from the day. But as I see the words, I realize how puny they feel in comparison with the reality I've experienced. I wish you that same light of Christ be born in you, and that in truth it spreads all over this world, lifting it up into heavenly realms. And so all of these experiences happen right within you. Isn't that marvelous? You don't have to wait for some future date at which Jesus chooses to return to this earth. You don't have to wait on anything except upon God, and to yearn for Him with everything in your heart, your mind, your soul, with all of your strength. And when you do, when you put aside the things of this world and you want God more than this world, then God will put you into action. Now that action may be difficult at times, it may frighten you at times, but to be fearless in your approach to God, knowing that whatever He brings to you, whatever situation He gives to you, He is looking after you, and He will bring you into the fulfillment of His promise. The promise of light, of joy, of bliss, of freedom, that is to be gained within and without. This is the promise that was made from the very foundation of this creation, and it resides in you still, and it will always reside in you. It is a gift that cannot be rescinded, and that no matter what dark paths you have taken in this life or other lifetimes, it does not disqualify you from entering into this inmost kingdom. any voice within you that tells you otherwise is a lie and a thief. The kingdom of heaven is indeed at hand. Feel that within you. Feel that it is calling to you. Now, if you'll pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of thy glorious presence,
in
every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for thee. I kneel in adoration at thy feet. And surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection. Surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence, are radiant with thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss. Of my communion with thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Blessed Spirit, I am he.
Ooh.